It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air.
Well, good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to the 96th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. My most recent pieces for the Westchester Guardian are at website www.westchesterguardian.com. They include the 170th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, enjoy them, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And John Mack is JohnMack. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. Try the newspaper. It's free, and you receive one email per day. The list of upcoming shows is also at the site. My guest next Sunday, July 19th, is human rights activist Rob McConte, who has spent most of his adult life in Guatemala. So this show, the 96th show in the series, callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Muro, my dentist. I've been going to Elizabeth's office for over 25 years, including the years that she was in college and dental school. The office once belonged to my long-term dentist and good friend Ron Friedman, who had to give up his practice due to the physical problem and was replaced by George Raymond, who was in turn replaced by Elizabeth. Good evening, Elizabeth, and welcome to the show.
Hi. Good evening, John. Thank you for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I was born in the Bronx. My parents and I lived in the Bainbridge area near Montetour Hospital.
Okay.
And we lived there until I was about 7 years old. And then we moved to Westchester County, Yonkers. And that's where I grew up and attended elementary school, actually in Pelham, at Our Lady of Perpetual Health from grades 3 to 6.
What were your earliest aspirations? Were you thinking of dental work then, or were you just a normal child?
Actually, I knew I always wanted to be a dentist. That happened in high school. I actually went to high school in Nourishell at Ursuline, and basically I was 16 years old at the time, and I got a job after school and on the weekends as a dental assistant at Quaker Ridge Dental Arts, right across from my high school. And there I worked as an assistant for two dentists. And I started out, you know, doing paperwork and filing, and then they trained me in the back, setting up the operatories and assisting them during procedures. And that's when I knew I wanted to be a dentist. So I was very intrigued, like, in seeing what they did for the patients, and I found it very rewarding. So I kept that job throughout high school into college, and then when I started, you know, college, I basically did all the prerequisites and pre-med programs that would, you know, later lead me into going to dental school.
Well, previous guest on this show, Ellen Hancock, went to Terrace Saline years ahead of you, and there's a building right off the Hutch of the Hancock Mooney of the Mooney Hancock Art Center, the Terrace Saline that she funded.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to say that, you know, Ursuline was a great school, and it was a great school there. It prepared you very well for, you know, for college and, you know, in the future endeavors that I, you know, proceeded with, but it was great there.
Terrace Saline nuns have that reputation. Ellen's a strong believer in same-sex Catholic education, and she went to College of New Rochelle, where she's contributed greatly to that, And she's the chairman of the board at Marist College. So she's a...
Okay.
She gets all around. Then where'd you go to college? Go ahead.
Our brother's school was like, I own a prep there that was close by. So, you know, with the sports and everything else, that was like our, you know, brother sister school. So when we had practices and stuff like that, and in high school, I did some, you know, track and swimming. So we had to go there to Iona for that at the time, because they didn't have like a field and whatnot there, but it was a great, great school.
I went to Iona College, and now when I went there, the prep was still on a college campus, and they moved off then, and the old prep building became the Hagen School of Business, where my wife teaches, and so I guess you were at the new prep building, their own campus.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, it was at the newer building.
And then college, where and what was your major?
I started at NYU, Fordham, I'm sorry, and my major was in biology. And so basically, you know, I did my four-year program there, and I figured I would do all the prerequisites that I needed, you know, so I did the pre-med program there. And, you know, taking all the courses, physiology, biology, chemistry, all that fun stuff. they all the prerequisites. So it was very good. And then after the 4 years there, I basically had to take the dental admission test. And I wanted to apply to schools in New York. And there are only four in New York, Stony Brook, Buffalo, Columbia, and NYU. So then I decided to go to NYU.
It's interesting. It's another of the coincidences. My daughter went to Fordham, and she spent much of her time, well, most of her time, on Rose Hill. She boarded there. But she also had courses at Lincoln Center, and they used to bus her back and forth. She had transferred from Lehigh, so she wanted, and she spent 2 years at Lehigh, and she not only changed school, but she changed majors. And she was able to finish in the 4 years, but it was by loading it down. And my son went to NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. He's a screenwriter, and my wife has a graduate degree in public administration from NYU. How long is dental school, and how intense is it? We always read about or see dramas about the intensity of both medical school and the intern process. Is dental school as intense? Would you describe the program for us?
I would have to say it's a 4-year program. I have to say that it was very intense. You know, like medical school, they say it's harder to get into medical school. You know, it was a little easier to get into dental school, but once you're in dental school, they had no qualms in like failing students. We started out with 250 students, and at the end of our fourth year, our graduating class was 150. So it was, you know, it was a very rigorous curriculum of dental courses, labs, and testing. Like the first 2 years comprised of like academic sciences, like the gross anatomy, physiology, all of that. We practiced on mannequin heads and Typhodon teeth. So we had to drill into these little plastic teeth and do fillings and other procedures on them. And then the last 2 years, in the third and fourth years, it was more hands-on, more clinical work when we started working on real people in the clinics, you know, under the supervision, of course. But I would have to say it was, you know, it was tough. It was very hard. Like, they definitely wanted to weed out the weaker students from the stronger ones. So, well, the one thing I say now, I would never, you know, I love my profession, but I would never want to do dental school all over again. That's definite. So.
Did it turn out to be what you expected, or at some point along the way, did you ever say, what am I doing here?
You know, I have to say, like, in the first 2 years were tough, you know, because you're taking maybe like eight sciences all at once, and you have like a test every other day. And you had to, like, attend lectures and then classes that have labs. So it was it was tough. You know, we would, like, break down and have our crying moments and crying spells. But, you know, I had a good class. And then we found, you know, a bunch of peers that we felt comfortable, you know, studying with. And we basically, you know, helped each other out. So it definitely made it easier in that aspect. But it was tough.
Did you board at NYU or did you commute?
No, I commuted. So at the time, we were living in Yonkers, so I basically took the train in Crestwood, the Metro North, and took to 23rd Street and took the, you know, the Grand Central to the 6th train on 23rd Street, and then because the dental school was on 23rd Street and 1st Avenue.
So
it was hard, too, with the commute and everything else.
And then when you graduated, how did you choose, or how did people choose for you where you did your internship?
No, you actually, at the time, you didn't, at that time when I graduated in 2004, you didn't have to do a residency if you didn't want to, but I chose to do one. And I basically applied to a Westchester Medical Center and Montefiore. I was accepted into both, but Westchester Medical Center was a little more local, and with the residency program, you had to do a lot of overnights and be on call every third to fourth night, and I figured, you know, Westchester Medical Center in Valhalla would have been, it was a much better fit for me. So I did that for a year after I graduated, and that's where, you know, I learned, I would say, you know, the most. Like, hands-on, it was great because it's a trauma hospital. You know, I didn't have to, not only did I do, you know, regular dental care and dental treatment, but we worked alongside oral surgery residents, and we saw, you know, motor vehicle accident patients that came in that had facial traumas, and we had to learn how to do facial lacerations and splints and stabilize, you know, teeth that were evolved. So I have to say, like, I really learned a lot, and I was really happy and glad that I, you know, took on that residency because, you know, it helps you out in private practice because sometimes, you know, even during the procedure, some dentist may nick someone's lip or, you know, and then they panic, you know. But doing that residency, you learn how to suture and all of this. So it was a great, great experience, I have to say.
You said that when you graduated, that was not mandatory. Is it now mandatory?
Yes, now every student has to do a residency. So the thing is, I don't know how they're even, because there are a lot of dental, you know, dental students, and a lot more people are going to dental school. And so the curriculum, I'm sure, and has to be very much harder and very competitive now, more so than when I went. But now it is, it's mandatory to do one.
And when you finished the residency, then where'd you wind up going?
When I finished residency, I applied for a job in White Plains. Dr. Donald Moskowitz. He had his own private practice. He was practicing for a while then. He was in his 70s. It was a nice, you know, it was a small office. And, you know, he taught me a lot. He was a great mentor. So he started me out slow, seeing patients, you know, and getting acclimated. Because, of course, when, you know, he was the only dentist there and he saw the patients, you know, sometimes it's hard for a patient to go to someone else because they're so used to, you know, someone working on their teeth. But, you know, he taught me a lot. And I worked there for about a year. And then one of my friends from residency program at the time was working across the hall from Dr. Delvecchio's office where I'm working now. And that's when he was, you know, he said that Dr. George Raymond, you know, my predecessor, was looking for an associate. So that's how I then went from from working in White Plains to Yorktown.
Jefferson Valley, Yorktown Heights, where I am. Yeah.
Yes.
You eventually purchased the program from George when he had to give up private practice due to a physical problem. Wow. I already mentioned that Ron Friedman had a physical problem. But I hope that it's not in the water there in your office.
No, I know. It's pretty scary, you know. It's unfortunate. George is, you know, in his 40s. He was young. He graduated dental school 2 years prior to me graduating. So he was fairly young, you know, and he had that, you know, medical ailment where, you know, with arthritis where he couldn't, you know, he was difficult working with his hands and his back. And, you know, it's scary, you know. It's one of the unfortunate circumstances, like, that can happen, you know. Even, like, dentistry, you know, can have a toll on your body, you know. The way we're working in small, you know, small space, focusing on a small object, the tooth, you know, causing even, like, eye straining, your eyes, back pain, the way we contort ourselves and for, you know, long periods of time in a certain position. And also the lovely sound of the drill, everyone's favorite, you know, to your hearing loss. But it's unfortunate when you have, you know, you succumb to problems where your back or your hands and stuff like that, it's very, very, it's very scary, you know.
George, as you know well, had been a police officer before he became a dentist. Then he was involved in a severe car crash that he had to have heavy dental work done to his face and reconstructive surgery, and that points him in the way of
wanting to be a dentist himself. So it's really unfortunate what happened, but yeah, he was in a car accident and that's when he knew that he wanted to go into that field. But luckily, like, he's still working as a teacher, you know, at NYU as a professor. So at least he's, you know, doing something that he enjoys and not totally, you know, detached from the field. But, you know, it's sad, especially any, like, physical limitation that can compromise your work and ability. You know, like, even as dentists, like, we purchase disability insurance to prevent that financial catastrophe if it were to happen. But, of course, it's not an ideal situation. And, you know, no one ever hopes to have to use it. And it's unfortunate, though, but it can happen. That's the thing, which is scary.
What's it like being responsible for a practice? Rent, accounting, insurance billing, staffing, advertising, et cetera? Did anything in dental school prepare you for the management
no,
of a practice?
Definitely not. That's the stuff that they did not teach you in dental school. It's like you have to learn as you go kind of thing. But I have to say it's a lot of work, you know. It has its pros and its cons, but, you know, working for someone, you don't have that responsibility. When I took over the practice, you know, George's practice in 2013, I have to say, like, I had to renovate the office, you know, then staff, finding staff, hygienist, office manager. So it's a lot of work, you know, it entailed a lot. And also, you know, coming up with the current, you know, software and installing computers, because there was really nothing in the office when I purchased it. It was very, you know, paper and pen type of thing. So I had to put a lot of work into it, but it got done, and we're happy where it is right now.
Are you having fun?
Yeah, no, I love what I do, you know. It's great. I love the most important. The nice part is my work is the people, and if you like to work with people, I certainly get a lot of people time, you know. It's a caring profession. The relationships are the best part. Also, the variety of cases that I see, it's challenging and interesting at the same time. Like, no 2 days are ever the same. And then when you think you've learned everything there is to learn, you'll see something new. And then also, like, I have to say, like, the hours are great, you know, especially for a woman, like, in the future also, like, to have a family. So, you know, the hours are good. You can basically set your own hours. And it's basically the best part is, like, it's rewarding. You know, you can change someone's life. People, you know, come in, they don't like their smile. They have, you know, poor self-esteem. And then you can do something to really make them, you know, happy and change that. So it's a good feeling.
I, as many in my immediate New York City neighborhood, were turned off on dentists that most of us went to. They were very nice fellows, but the halls of the apartment building they were in always smelled like drilling. There was always a noise throughout the building. Although I went to some good dentists when I got older. I even held Eleanor Roosevelt's coat in the office of one of them. It was only on an as-needed basis, pain or cavity. It was not until Ron Freeman that I really became the regular patient. Then that slipped a bit after his retirement. And now you've got me. What's the most difficult aspects of running the practice and keeping patients happy enough to keep coming back?
Like exactly what you're saying, like those patients that are anxious. There are lots of patients, you know, that have a dental phobia that deters them from getting treatment or have had a traumatic past experience. You know, I get it all the time. The patients come in, they say, I like you, but I hate coming here, you know, like a love-hate relationship. But it's important, like, to have a lot of patience with these patients like this because you want to make patients comfortable and, you know, talk them through procedures to lessen their fear. And some patients that fear, you know, coming to the dentist or they just cancel their appointments or don't show up at all, you know, it's just we have, like, my office is good at educating, you know, the patient that comes in and having them understand that not coming in or not doing a certain thing can only make matters worse. So I would say, you know, dealing with that anxious person and, you know, is difficult because you want to promote good oral health and you want patients to feel comfortable coming to you. You know, you don't want that fear. But, you know, unfortunately, sometimes there are those, you know, traumatic experiences that you can't let go of and it really causes an issue.
What do you do, if anything, special with very young children to try to break them in that the dentist is their friend, even though this may hurt a bit and it's going to be good for them in the long run? How do you handle children?
Usually with the little kids, like the parents that come in, I usually tell them at the age, it's always good to start bringing them in, like when they come in for treatment, so that they could become acclimated with the office and the staff. But then when we see patients usually around, like, 2.5, 3, like, you know, we work, and my staff and the hygienists are very good at, you know, making it fun and making them involved and, you know, showing and explaining things to them. And we're saying that we're going to count your teeth right now and so that they open their mouth, open like a lion. You know, we just make it fun, saying that we're going to, you know, polish their teeth and make them shiny and then telling them how it's important for them, you know, to brush twice a day and things like that. So we've been very good. Even though my practice is not a pediatric practice, we do see a lot of kids. And as they start coming in, they do become acclimated. And, of course, you know, when you have, you know, a child that is very fearful or anxious that needs a specialty like the pediatric dentist, then we definitely, like, refer to our colleagues that, you know, just specialize in that one thing.
I've never been to a dentist that didn't have bad things to say about the work that was done by someone previously. Is that unique to the profession? I don't normally get that from doctors. I've had so many dentists look at my mouth and say, who did this?
Yeah, again, you just want to try to maintain. You know, obviously, you really can't you can and can't critique on someone's work because you don't know the conditions or the experience they had. Because sometimes you can do something to the best of your ability, but, you know, not every patient is the same and not every situation is the same, you know. You can try, maybe a patient is really, does not want to have a tooth pulled, let's say, and they want to try to hold on to it for dear life. So you try to do a procedure that can at least, like, let's say, buy time for, you know. So it's not the ideal situation, but, you know, sometimes things don't always work out the way you plan for it to work out, let's say, but.
You mentioned pediatric dentistry. There are many different terms that we hear that the audience may not be familiar with when you hear about dentists and dental surgeons and orthodontists. What are the different categories of people who may be working in your mouth at some time?
So the different specialties, so as a general dentist, you can basically dabble in all aspects of dentistry, which is like oral surgery, endodontics, prosthodontics, which I'm going to explain. But an oral surgeon is someone that basically specializes. It's a doctor who does more schooling. It's another 4 years after dental school, and doing like extractions, orthognathic surgeries, where like there's like in some cases where the jaw has to be broken to be brought forward or back. The oral surgeon also restores implants. Another type of specialty is an endodontist, and that's someone who just does root canals. So when a cavity is very large, it goes into the nerve of the tooth, and at that point, the nerve has to be taken out of the tooth and restored. So a root canal specialist is the person who does that. And then another specialty is a prosthodontist. And that's a person who, a doctor who specializes in doing bridge work, crowns, aesthetic dentistry. They do more like complex cases like that. And then the pediatric dentist is someone who just deals with kids, usually up to the age of, you know, 9 or 10. And they have, you know, different techniques that they use, or they have sedation for the children, or, you know, nitrous oxide, which is like a gas, like a laughing gas that puts them in another zone just so that they don't feel as nervous. Then another specialty is orthodontics, and that's, you know, for braces and for young kids and adults. But the thing is, as a general dentist, you can dabble in, you know, but of course, any of the hard cases or complex cases that as a dentist we feel that, you know, are out of our realm to do, then, or warrants a specialist, then we just would refer to our colleagues to do that.
In one of our recent conversations, you told me of many fairly new breakthroughs and innovations that make dental care easier for the patient and therefore more efficient for the dentist. Would you take us through some of these and take as long as you'd like in describing them?
Oh, yes, there are a lot of different technologies. One that is fairly, that has come a long way, are the dental implants. And basically what the dental implant is, it's a man-made replacement for a tooth root. So it's ideal for patients who have a missing tooth or multiple teeth. And they can also be used to replace an upper or lower jaw. And what basically a dental implant is, it's made up of titanium due to its strength and its ability to fuse to bone over time. And the process of the implant fusing to bone is called osseointegration, and that can take up to 6 months depending on the condition of the bone. And basically, once this implant integrates, an impression is then taken, and a final crown or bridge can be made. And the abutment is the part that attaches to the actual implant. So it like screws into the implant, and it sticks out from the gum. And then it's like torqued down, and then a final crown or bridge is cemented on, and it's like having your own tooth. So it's amazing. And now they, you know, a lot more people are getting this done, and it's the best thing. It's come a long way. Another technology, which is pretty amazing, I don't have this in my office. I would love to have this in the future, but it's an actual machine called the CAD-CAM, which stands for computer-assisted design, computer-assisted manufacture technologies. And what this machine does, it can make a crown in one visit. Basically, the patient comes in, and you're able to leave the same day with this crown. And what it does, basically, I'll just summarize it quickly, is you take a scan of the prepared tooth or of the surrounding teeth, and what basically it takes, the scan is a digital impression, and it draws the data into a computer. And the software then creates a replacement part for your tooth that's missing. And it basically creates like a virtual restoration. And it's the software then sends this data to a milling machine where it then carves out at a from a solid block of ceramic or composite resin, it makes the actual tooth, the crown, and it, you know, stains and glazes could be added on afterwards to match the shade of the patient's teeth. But it it offers a quick service. So instead of waiting like a week for a crown to come back from the lab and wearing a temporary, this machine can offer a one-day service for patients, and they leave with a permanent crown in the same day. It's a great machine.
So go ahead.
The thing is, it's a great machine, but it's costly. Like, the machine and the software could be like $100,000 just to purchase. So it's quite an investment.
That will come down. Now you're in my bailiwick, technology. And for years, architects and draftsmen spent, they had these big boards that were sitting on the kind of thing that we see stopping traffic, and they would draw very extensive things. Then along came CAD CAM, as you mentioned, and computer manufacturing, and the company called Autodesk that had the software, and it immediately changed the whole architectural and design thing. Now we have 3D printing that when you design something, that you can manufacture it there on the spot. And in the beginning, these things were extremely expensive. Now people have the products on their PCs or the Macintosh. Now you still obviously have to have both the printer and the 3D printer in that, and that would be expensive. But give it 10 years, and you'll all have them in your office.
I would hope so, but. You know, this machine, it's great. It's just very, very expensive. Like, a lot of programs, you know, the thing is, like, there are a lot of things, even, like, digital x-rays, which I did incorporate into my office when I purchased the practice, because they just had traditional x-rays there. They're quite expensive, you know. Just the software alone for the digital x-rays is, like, $15,000, $16,000. You know, we're hoping that in the future, you know, the price does go down because, you know, a lot of offices, it makes it easier for the patients, you know, to have these newer technologies, and it just makes life a lot easier. But with the digital x-rays, I wanted to actually touch upon that, which is another technology that's very amazing because in the sense that the benefit is reducing exposure to radiation, you know, and it just allows, like, the picture of your tooth to just pop up on a computer screen in an instant. You know, in the past, like, an x-ray could, you know, took a long time for the film to develop, biting down on those horrible-tasting cardboard x-ray tabs. So, you know, with the digital x-ray, it reduces the time of waiting for the film to develop, and it just makes it much quicker. So especially for those patients that have a very bad gag reflex, you know, it makes it a lot easier for them. But, again, with these technologies, it is pretty expensive, and just hopefully, you know, it does go down in time.
Ron had something in the office, it's a good 10 or 12 years ago. We had it they gave it to him for the 3-month trial, and it was amazing. He could actually see what he was doing on a big screen. It enlarged everything, and it also related it to there must have been the digital X-ray then, but apparently it was very expensive, and he decided that it wasn't worth the benefit, and he gave it back. But I was amazed by it, and I was interested in it, obviously being a technologist. What else is new?
There is great. Also, another thing that's new is it's out there. People are using it. Or the dental laser, a laser dentistry. There are different types of lasers, like water lasers, carbon dioxide. There's so many different, you know, ones that are used, and they're basically. A lot of the lasers are seen in the field by periodontists, people who deal with, you know, the gum tissue, where they have to, people have gummy smiles or they have to remove, you know, the gum tissue. So it makes procedures less invasive, The laser is also used in some areas, like for dental fillings, using this film. But again, there's a learning curve with them because, you know, unlike using a regular drill to drill a filling, you know, with a laser, basically you can't feel, you don't have that like tactile sense. So there's a big learning curve with those. But you see a lot of that coming about now. And what's amazing is, you know, how we, all these technologies that come about, keeping up with everything, that's the other thing, that, you know, they have different, that different journals that come out all the time, or we have big conventions and meetings that we go to learn about all this stuff. There's actually a great dental meeting here in New York, and which they have once a year around Thanksgiving at the, it's called the Greater New York Dental Meeting, and they hold it at the, held at the Jacob Javits Center. And millions of dentists from around the world attend there, and they offer a multitude of courses that one can take, and they show the new technologies there. Like, they have a convention floor open for dentists, staff, and guests, and they to show the newest products and advancements. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is very interesting. How else do you keep up with it? Are there additional courses that you can take, whether online or residents, or are there any requirements for relicensing to do so many educational units? The way there are
actually, there are relicensing. You need every 3 years to renew our license. We need, now they increased it, I believe, I think it's 60 credits or 60 CE credits that are required. A small portion of them, I think the number is around 18 or so. 18 CE credits can be taken online, but the others have through a lecture or a course that you go to. And basically, like, some seminars are offered by the districts in the community. In Westchester, like the 9th District, other various courses are offered by the ADA, which is the American Dental Association. Some dental journals and blogs that we go on, some dental journals have, like, CE courses. They basically reading an article, answering questions, submitting it, and you can get credit that way. And sometimes, actually, our colleagues from different specialties have courses and lectures that they keep us up to date with the advancements in their particular field or specialty, which makes it, you know, a nice time where, you know, a colleague could get together, have little discussions, and, you know, discuss different treatment plans and how we learn in that aspect as well.
Now, you mentioned districts. How do these districts work, and districts of what?
Basically, they have, like, Westchester, the 9th District, basically all the people in, you know, I would say, like, White Plains and Yorktown. They basically have these districts set up where they have commute, like, you can take certain courses. Then the Bronx, they have their own district where they have, a dental association associated with them, just so that it makes it easier for, you know, to compartmentalize the different dentists in the area and having different lectures and things like that.
Now, is it a dental association, or is it part of the ADA?
The
what exactly
ADA
is it?
Has to join. Usually the membership is like $2,000 a year, I would say. But they do provide some great CE courses. They have like maybe two or three courses held throughout the year with different lecturers from different fields, like either oral surgery, discussing implants, or things like that. And basically that is by, you know, joining and putting in your dues, you can go to those courses at no cost and get the credits that you need.
Now,
but I've done a great course. Dr. Delvecchio has a lot of CE credits and workshops, and he had a great mini residency program about implants, and I partook in that with Dr. Valente across, he's a prosthodontist in the same complex where I work now in Jefferson Valley. He's in the other building across. So, you know, we get together, we bring our complex cases, we talk about them, So it makes it a great learning experience.
Are there also credits for the conference that you mentioned at the Javits? Are the courses actually given there also?
Yeah, there are courses there. Some are, you know, that you don't purchase, you don't have to pay for, which are like maybe a credit or not, you know, things like that. But there are other courses that they do have there, which I actually, 2 years ago, I took a course there for Invisalign, which are the clear braces. And basically it was a 1 day course. They also, then you get your certification in whatever you choose to do. I took it for the orthodontics. I don't do like braces and complete orthodontics. That I refer to my colleagues who just specialize in that. But I was able to get a certification in the Invisalign, just the simple cases. I don't do anything really complex. But it's very, you know, you can touch upon different aspects of dentistry that you really like, and you can, you know, make further advancements in that during taking these courses.
Topic. I see from your short bio that you speak both Spanish and Italian in addition to English. Where did the two Romance languages come from?
Well, both my parents were born in Italy. So, and they came here when they were probably, when they were 16 and 18, and they met here. So growing up, both, basically my parents have always spoken in Italian to me. So I picked that up rather quickly. And then when I was in high school, I took Spanish up as a language, and I continued that in college as well. So I took 7 years of Spanish altogether. And it was very easy to me because of the Italian. They're similar. And I enjoy languages. So that's how I learned, you know, Spanish. And then Italian just came naturally just by my parents.
Do you keep up with them? Do you keep up with the languages?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. I speak it with my parents all the time. Sometimes when I speak Spanish, I will say some words in Italian and vice versa. But it's great. You know, it makes it, it's a great plus in my profession as well, because I have Italian patients, I have Spanish patients, and it's great to be able to communicate with them and, you know, speaking their language and making them understand what we're, you know, doing. So
I've absolutely no gift for languages, because I was never willing to put the time in, but I knew this priest at Fordham who used to be a theology professor there, who spoke something like 36 languages, and he read in
wow.
60. He was a biblical scholar, so he was into Juridic and all these different languages. Then I have the friend who went to Xavier High School, and he used to run around the neighborhood speaking Latin for the first 2 years. He'd annoy the hell out of us with omnis gallius, and say stop. Then he got into German, and he was even worse. And he went to Manhattan, and he took all the advanced courses, and he tutored German, and he was all set to go to St. Louis Medical School. And he had a falling out with an organic chemistry teacher in the end of his senior year, where he said that he did something right, and the teacher said he didn't, or vice versa. But the teacher gave him a D, and St. Louis pulled his acceptance. So he's running all over, and his grandparents spoke Italian phrases, but he really didn't know Italian. But he got accepted. He got accepted to the University of Milan, and he went to Berlitz for 6 weeks, and then off he went to Milan, and everything was in Italian. He wound up tutoring in Italian, and paying his tuition, and he traveled around Europe, married the German girl, and. And they came back here, and they have bilingual kids. He's a cardiologist. So it's just amazing that some people seem to have this gift and others don't.
No, it is a gift. And a quick story that it's funny. In Ursuline, I remember it was the beginning of high freshman year, we had the choice between art class or taking Latin with the principal. And there was Sister Jean Baptiste Nicholson at the time. She recently passed away, and I decided to take Latin an hour before classes started. Everyone thought I was crazy, but I always found it interesting. You know, I always had I liked languages.
But you dropped the Latin after a while? Would you do it through?
Yeah,
through
it was only
years?
It was only 2 years of Latin. It helped with the SATs and stuff like that, because, you know, word origins and whatnot. But I would have to say Latin was pretty, you know, it was tricky. It was hard.
You only got to Caesar. You didn't do Cicero, then Virgil, if I remember correctly.
We just had to do the Iliad, I believe, in translating that. That was, like, torturous. But I enjoyed languages, have to say.
What's next for Dr. Elizabeth Miro?
I just would like continuing my practice. I've owned the practice now for 2 years. We've made a lot of advancements with introducing the digital x-rays and renovating and everything else. So, you know, I'd like to continue that, hopefully, in the future. I have to say that they're great team players. You know, I'm very happy. They're part of my practice. They're very courteous, and they deal with all my patients in a caring, compassionate manner. And I think that makes, you know, the office an inviting place. And, you know, I have to say patients have always, you know, complimented on that. So I'm very happy to have them as my staff.
You're right. They're terrific.
They are.
We've touched a lot of bases. What else would you like our audience to know about Elizabeth Miro? Anything, family, home, practice, hobbies?
Hobbies, I have to say, I like to cook. You know, I enjoy cooking. Both my husband and myself like to cook, actually. So, you know, baking and things like that. So that's one thing that I do like. And spending time with family and friends as well.
What about outdoor things or reading or technology or any of that?
Like outdoors, I used to skate when I was younger also. So from time to time, like I don't do that as often as I would like, but I really enjoy ice skating. So in the winter, you know, it's nice to go down to, you know, Rockefeller Center, or I used to go to Murray's all the time in Yonkers. So I do that from time to time. I enjoy doing that.
You've got Van Cortlandt Park too. That's a nice lake, and that's not very expensive. Right, in the North Bronx. All right. Well.
Yes.
We've touched a lot of bases. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
No, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And now a bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmac13.johnmacrants. That's johnmacrants.com. And I also have the newspaper that I'd like you all to take a look at, that you can see at www.johnmac13.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website and for information on the upcoming shows. And as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silva. Whoa, whoa. Easy, big fella. Easy. Thank you.